Okay, last week I finished at the point where we were talking about the Parliament and in particular the Union with the different elements of the United Kingdom. So let's get as far as that. Yes, so I mentioned the Union with Wales, which on the one hand was much more complete. Well, in general, was much more complete than the unions with the other elements. Partly because it was a military conquest, and the results are visible even today. If you look at the Department of Education, the laws on education come through, and it's all schools in England and Wales. And then you have a different law about Scotland and Northern Ireland. You have that England and Wales have the same education system, have the same legal system as well, whereas in Scotland it's different. So it's a much bigger political union. However, culturally, the desire for independent identity has still been quite strong, and in particular the Welsh language. I'm sure you're aware that the Welsh language has survived in a much, much stronger position than the Scottish Gaelic or Irish Gaelic. That there are the number of people speaking Welsh is actually rising and not falling. It's been for 10 years. It's been rising, which is quite an achievement, really, because it's not easy to do that. Okay, so let's have a quick look at it. Well, we will come back to Wales. And in particular, the long campaigns during the 20th century for the defence of the Welsh language, which has been one of the vectors. Certainly, Welsh nationalism has been more cultural and Scottish nationalism more political for the whole of the 20th century. This is not only because of the oil in Scotland, which is worth millions and millions of pounds. And, of course, if you have oil worth millions and millions of pounds, you feel more political. That there is a defence of the right of Scotland to the revenue for the oil, whereas in Wales there's not really a lot of money involved, and so the cultural takes the foreground. If we go over to Scotland, a long tradition then of independence in Scotland. Important to remember then that there's no, you can't talk about a single opinion of the Scottish people. For a long time, in the Middle Ages, then a feudal system in Scotland, quite independent from Britain. But even much later, a long period when in the Highlands, sheep farming and or subsistence farming, and so quite a conflict between the industrial parts around Glasgow and Edinburgh and Dundee, and the Highlands and Islands, as we say, the Highlands and Islands, which remained Gaelic speaking much longer. One of the first indications of Scottish separatist identity is the Declaration of Arbroath in 1320, and it simply says that we must have separate kings for Scotland. And that. The Declaration of Arbroath, Declaration of Scottish Independence, made in 1320. It's actually a letter to the Pope, intended to confirm Scotland's status as an independent sovereign state and defending Scotland's right to use military action when unjustly attacked. So that's going back a long way, of course. However, it is in 1707 that you have the Act of Union. This follows a period when the two countries were separate but had the same king. Before this, there was a period when they shared a monarch. From 1603, James I of England became James VI of Scotland. So for the whole of the 17th century, you had the same king, but completely different laws, completely different parliament, etc. The Act of Union in 1707 will establish a permanent union between the two states. And we need to look a little bit about that. Now, today, people look at the union between Scotland and England in various ways. You have the unionists and the nationalists. Remember that in the context of Scotland and Ireland, the unionists, so some palais syndicalistes, palais unionists, come trade unionists, it's the people in favour of the union with England. So the unionists are the opposite of the nationalists in Scotland and in Ireland. Well, the unionists today, and historians who are from the unionist tradition, see 1707 as the beginning of the civilisation of Scotland, whereas, of course, the nationalists see it as a colonisation. It was not a military conquest. The Scottish elite agreed. Probably most of the Scottish people were not in favour. However, it was not a democratic country at the time, so that wasn't a big problem. The Scottish elite agreed to it. However, they insisted on very serious concessions. It was a negotiated agreement between the Scottish elite and the English elite. There's a song about it. We were bought and sold for English gold. This is the nationalist point of view. Yeah, the elite, the aristocracy sold Scotland because they wanted English gold. Okay, so that's one vision of what happened. Why did the Scottish elite accept the union? Well, at this time there was the threat of a war between France and England. In fact, there was off war on and off between France and England. France at this time represented in the mind of the Scottish an absolutist country, a feudal country. And really the situation was such that if the Scottish elite had not agreed to union with England, France would probably have invaded Scotland. There was a war, Scotland was there, not as many people, not as big an army. There was a fair chance that France would have invaded. So in a way, the Scottish elite were kind of obliged to choose. Shall we join England or shall we join Scotland? They decided to join England. Doesn't mean they were very happy about it, but they decided to join England because England represented a more modern country after the glorious revolution of 1688, the king had limited power. Yeah, they had the civil war 1640, the glorious revolution, Notre Dame, 1688. The king had a lot less power, and so the Scottish elite felt better that way. However, they decided that they wanted serious concessions, and today you can still see the result of the serious concessions. In Scotland, the Church, the Protestant Church of Scotland, was a very important influence, of course. They were very different from the English Church. At this time in England, you have the Church of England, yeah, with the head is the king, yeah. And in Scotland, something completely different, and that is a Presbyterian church, no bishops, which is very important, yeah, much less hierarchical. The belief, of course, as all the different Protestant groups believed, they believed that they were the true Christian way of doing things. And so one of the big conditions is, we will have union with England, but we want to keep our religion. We don't want the Church of England being established, and in particular, we don't want bishops, because bishops represent a hierarchical type of church. And this was agreed. The English were a little desperate, so they agreed. Secondly, another influential group, the lawyers of Edinburgh. Lawyers are always important. In the 17th, 18th century, lawyers are very important. If you look at the French Revolution, a load of lawyers, the Jacobins are a bunch of lawyers. I'm exaggerating, but very important part of the new urban elite. And the lawyers also were not going to accept the union without serious concessions, and the concessions were that the Scottish legal system would remain separate, and it is still separate today. Did I tell you last week that if you are accused of murder, yeah, in a Scottish court, you have three possible results: guilty, innocent, or not proven. Also, the number of jurors is different. And finally, the Church of Scotland demanded something else: a separate education system. And even today, the education system is separate. So, a separate legal system, a separate education system, and a separate church. These are some of the material bases for a very strong Scottish identity. There is a strong Scottish identity, but it's easier to have a strong Scottish identity if everybody in Scotland has had the same education system, but not the people in England. You've got something to be separate about. So that identity doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from things you've really shared. And so a different idea of what is correct for the church, and much more democratic, in fact, the Scottish church, no bishops, and the Presbyterian. Presbyterian, the majority church in Scotland is Presbyterian. Presbyter is a council. So there's a committee in each town which runs the church. It's a very relatively democratic thing. Like some of the American churches, which are, you know, because we're French, we often imagine the church as like the Catholic Church, you know, really hierarchical. Democracy doesn't come into it. But some of the churches in America are extremely democratic. This takes a little time. There is negotiations between the English elite and the Scottish elite. But England doesn't want a war. The alternative is a war with Scotland. And England doesn't want a war with Scotland because they're preparing a war with France. And, you know, it's an old rule. Don't have wars on two sides at the same time. You know, remember this if you're ever tempted to go to war. And so the union is signed in 1707. And even if the Scots are not so happy, they will defend the union later on. In 1715 and 1745, there are rebellions supported by France. To 1715 and 1745, there are rebellions to restore a different monarch, and these rebellions against the English king then are supported by France, of course. It makes sense at the time. Yeah, 1715, 1745. The rebellions. Now, this week I printed out my slide, so I know what I'm getting before I press the button, which is good. So if we go over to Ireland, the third element then, and certainly if you look at the long period, then you have them in order. The most complete union between England and Wales, a slightly more complicated compromise union with Scotland, and the difficulty is not finished. There's going to be a referendum next year, in 2 years' time, for independence in Scotland. So there's still a tension. But certainly, by any measurement, the least successful union was the union with Ireland, from the point of view of the English elite. So an act of union were passed by the Westminster Parliament and the Dublin Parliament. Although, remember, of course, the parliaments at this time are not democratic institutions. Only a very small percentage of the population can vote. You have to be careful. Whenever we use the word parliament, we kind of feel like we're talking about democracy. But that's only the case after the 19th century. So a permanent union between the two countries under one parliament, and creating then in 1800 the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. The whole of Ireland is then part of the United Kingdom. The union does acknowledge a degree of Irish distinctiveness, but does not concede the institutional autonomy enjoyed by the Scots. Why not? Well, one of the reasons is that they couldn't possibly say, okay, you can keep a lot of power and influence for your religion, because the Irish religion was
Catholic.
And France is the big enemy, the big Catholic enemy, so you can't encourage they'll join the French and make war with us, yeah? To being Catholic for a long period of time in the 17th and 18th century was, they are probably in league with France and Spain, our enemies. Yeah, that was the idea. Yeah. Sometimes it was true, but certainly there was no chance of giving autonomy to the Irish religiously. And so that was the situation. The other thing which was special about Ireland is that the colonisation had been rather specific. There had been, when Oliver Cromwell in the 1640s went over to Ireland to defeat an Irish revolt, the lands were taken from the Irish and given to Protestant supporters of Oliver Cromwell, Scottish and English. And so you had already a division in Ireland between the Protestant colonisers and the Catholic peasants. And so there was already the seeds of a conflict which is not finished even today. That was the union with Ireland. And we will, of course, come back to that because it's become one of the most unusual political situations in the world. You have a colony, and then you give 2/3 of it freedom, and you count the rest as part of your country, but you have to send the army to persuade the people living there that they still want to be close to England. It's really a bit of a mess, And they tried many, many times to solve the problem, and so far, with many, many ups and downs. And, of course, the flag, the famous flag, the Union Jack. I think it's later it's called the Union Jack. Originally it's called the Union Flag. It still remains the flag of the United Kingdom, which combines the flags of England, which includes Wales, so you can see how perfect the union was. No need to put a separate bit for Wales in, because we beat Wales by military conquest. We're not worried about the opinion of Wales, so England, which includes Wales. Scotland, the cross of St. Andrew, the white vertical cross on a blue background, and the St. Patrick's cross, of course, to represent Ireland. So you put all three of them together. It's very, very unusual. How many countries in the world have a flag which is made up of flags representing the different bits which came? It's not a very traditional thing to do. More typical is France with a flag which didn't represent part of France, but which represented an event, the revolution, the tricolour of the revolution. Yeah. Okay, so you've got the Union Jack still in there. Interesting history of the Union Jack, though, because it represents this union and does not represent the founding events like the revolution or the American Revolution and so on, you don't see it much around. If you walk around any old town in France, you see the French flag everywhere. Oh, c'est le commissariat, oh, c'est un lycée. They're everywhere. And in Britain, if you see a flag, it's probably the Conservative Party headquarters for the town, or something even more right-wing. It's not a people's flag. So it's brought out for particular occasions. When one of the princes gets married or dies, or something like that. But it's not something that you see walking down the street every day. I don't know what this is doing here, actually. This is a petite parenthèse, I think. This is a caricature of the Englishman, and this is a cartoonist called George Cruikshank, and he did this in 1819. You can see the caricature is very negative. Here you have the free-born Englishman, the admiration of the world. You can see he has a big padlock in his mouth. He no freedom of speech because his mouth is locked. He's standing on the Bill of Rights. And where's the Magna Carta? Oh, he's standing on it. Yes, he's just standing on it. He's not respecting it. He's standing on it. He is carrying a note which says, freedom of the press means transportation. That is, if you try to defend freedom of the press, you will be sent to Australia as a prisoner. So this is a sarcastic cartoon. 1819, important date 1819, if we're talking about the history of liberty, because 1819 is the date of, anybody know? Yes, thank you. Yes, the Peterloo Massacre. This was a meeting in Manchester to defend, to ask for democratic reform, and it was attacked by the forces of the police, and quite a number of people were killed, and it was a big scandal of 1819. So the Parliament then represents, for a long time, represents England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, with members of Parliament coming from all those places. Until 1919, when the situation for Ireland changes. And of course, at the end of the 20th century, then there is a change with the establishment of the Scottish Parliament, the re-establishment of the Scottish Parliament, and the establishment of the Welsh Assembly. We'll be looking at that at the moment. Now, we were saying that the Britain doesn't base its way of organising politics on a written constitution, so we have no constitutional council like you have in France or in the United States. Of course, it's the Supreme Court that interprets the constitution. We don't have a constitution. It's just a kind of tradition. The House of Commons follows the lead of the Prime Minister of the day, and there's a big gap between the reality, the theory and the reality of British government. For example, in the form, it is the Queen who chooses the Prime Minister. And in theory, she can choose anybody she wants. But in practice, she always chooses the leader of the party who has won the elections. And this is a very British way of doing things. It doesn't say anywhere in writing that the Queen must choose the leader of the biggest party in Parliament, but she always does. And this is a very, very British way of doing things. And there is, the House of Commons usually follows the lead of the Prime Minister of the day, and no binding and comprehensive statement exists as to how the latter may or may not use his or her power. So it's very difficult to attack a Prime Minister for overstepping the limits or abuse of power, because there's no written definition of what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Why does it work? Obviously, it partly works because the elite need people to believe in the democratic process, and so they must follow what are accepted to be traditional rules. And some of these are written down. And one of the lawyers who is the one of the most influential 19th century lawyers, Albert Dicey, he wrote a history of parliaments. And he stressed the importance of parliamentary sovereignty, that is, that Parliament is the most powerful. And he insisted on the need to respect Britain's existing and historic constitutional conventions. Yeah, so the conventions are some des traditions. They're not written documents, they're just conventions. That's the way it's always been done. And this applies to the role of the Speaker in the House of Commons, for example. The Speaker of the House of Commons. C'est qui the speaker? How would you say this in French? In the House of Commons, the speaker? Yeah? No, it's not the porte-parole. What is the role of the speaker? C'est le président de l'Assemblée. Yeah? Yeah. He's called the speaker. Why not? Why? And he does all sorts of... There's all sorts of really rather strange traditions. On the day of the opening of Parliament, the Queen comes to the Parliament and they close the door to stop her getting in. And then her special servant has to knock on the door, and then it's opened again. It's all very British. It's very, very bizarre. All countries do have bizarre traditions. But there's something particularly strange about the British ones. At the opening of every parliamentary session, you have the Queen's speech. Every time the Parliament opens, once a year, for example, approximately once a year, I think. Maybe it's not so often. Maybe it's not every year. I think it's every year. The Queen gives a speech in the Parliament, and she doesn't say anything about the Queen. She says, "My government will do this. My government will do that." It's the general announcing of policy. Just like in France, I'm sure it's the same thing, that when you have a new government, they say, "Oh, right, this is what we're going to do," at the beginning of the parliament. Well, that's what... But the Queen reads it. But the Queen has not written it. Okay, so it's, "My government will do this, my government will do that." And, of course, she says this if it's a Conservative government or a Socialist government. It doesn't matter, it's still the Queen who says it. And so you have this... really is rather special situation where you have the Queen reading out what's... I mean, I don't know what they would do if the government said we're going to abolish the monarchy. So, "My government will abolish me." traditions there. But also, probably relatively respectful of freedom. The Parliament remains the British Parliament, the Parliament of Britain and Ireland, for a long time, with some difficulties because... we will come back to this later, but for a long time, Catholics are not allowed to be members of Parliament until 1829, I think. And we'll come back to that. During the First World War, there was a rebellion in Ireland in 1916, the Easter Rebellion, and quite a small group of guerrillas took control of the General Post Office in Dublin. The General Post Office is very important when they control all the radio and telephone. And declare the independence of Ireland. But this declared independence of Ireland in 1916 only lasts for a few days, and the British Army repress and destroy this revolt and immediately shoot the leaders, execute the leaders immediately. Because they are rather worried. However, this uprising, which is not successful, inspires quite a lot of people to want independence for Ireland. And so immediately the First World War is finished, the war continues in Ireland between the British and the Irish for the question of independence. If you want to see a good film about this, The Wind Shakes the Barley, Le Vent se Lève, en français, of Ken Loach. It's not fun, but it you understand more about the situation in Ireland after the First World War, and also the terrible poverty of the farmers, of the peasants. And the result is a compromise. So the British cannot win, although they have a much bigger army, but their army wants to go home, really. They had the First World War. The army wants to go home. My grandfather was in the British Army in Ireland in 1919. In my opinion, on the wrong side, but there you go. And so they had a compromise. They said, "Well, we will divide the island. We will divide Ireland. We'll make a line, make a partition." Which is a very original way of dealing with. There are some other examples: Cyprus, Chypre. Divided, North Korea, South Korea, etc. It can be done. It's not always a great idea. And so the result is they draw a line. Now, the line is not... First of all, the line does not correspond to any historic division. The nine counties of the north were Ulster, but the line is six counties of the north for England, and the rest, independence. Why these six counties? Anybody know why these six counties? Two reasons. Political, yeah?
They voted if they wanted to stay in the Union or if they wanted
to... I don't think they did vote. But certainly they had a majority. Yeah, there's certainly some sort of thing. And what was the most important social element there is that they are the six parts with majority Protestants. Protestant majorities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Protestant majorities, that was the key part. And the other reason is because that they were the richest and most industrialised parts of the country, and so England could not keep the whole of Ireland, they certainly wanted to keep Belfast and Londonderry, which is where the money was. Belfast is not a very good example, but Belfast is where the Titanic was built. Now, okay, the Titanic is not the best example, but they built some big ships, yeah. the question of Protestants and money is important there, because the reason that these were the most industrialised and richest pots of town is because the English invested in the pots of the country where there were Protestants. So they're not two questions, they're one question, in fact. And there was no investment in the Catholic parts of the country because nobody cared. And so we get a situation where six counties of the north belong to England, belong to Great Britain, and the rest of Ireland is now independent. It's the Irish Free States. It's not the Irish Republic. It becomes a republic much later. Yeah, so the Queen accepts to remain the Queen of an independent Southern Ireland because they want to stop the war. So this is this rather strange compromise. And the treaty, the Anglo-Irish Treaty of this time, will become the most, even till today, really, it will become the founding division in Irish political life. The two main political parties in Ireland for the last 60 years were those who thought the treaty was a wonderful thing and those who thought the treaty was a terrible thing. And shortly afterwards then, the name of the country becomes the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Well, then you just have a picture of some soldiers in 1922. Oh, look, it's my grandfather. And of course, for the rest of the 20th century and even today, there are plenty of Irish people who think that, you know, Ireland is one island and one culture and should be united. And this, of course, caused a lot of problems and of course, a sort of low-level civil war from the 60s till the 80s. For 20 years. And today the situation is much calmer, well, there's less violence, for reasons which are not completely clear. But we'll come back to that as well. So, if we come to today, then we've got the United Parliament for Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, Northern Ireland actually had a special status, because from 1922... there was a separate parliament in Northern Ireland. So there were two parliaments, one in London and one in Northern Ireland from 1922 on. No parliament in Scotland at this time, no parliament in Wales at this time, but parliament in Northern Ireland, which was very much an instrument of Protestant domination. The Protestant domination in Northern Ireland was very, very strong. Even in the 1970s, you had a situation where I think 35 or 40% of the population was Catholic and 96% of the police were Protestant. It was a massive difference. And all the jobs in the big industries, all the jobs were Protestants. In fact, when they wanted to recruit people, they asked the Protestant organisations for people. And so it was a very, very negative situation from the point of view of civil rights. And the big conflicts of the 1960s and 1970s begin with a demand for civil rights, inspired by the movement in America of African Americans. The Catholics in Northern Ireland say, no, we want the same rights as everybody else. Today the situation is better. If you go to get a job in Northern Ireland, they don't say, are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic? They say, what school did you go to? Well, the School of the Virgin Mary. Ah, okay. Of course, they always know if you're a Catholic or a Protestant. You can't. And one of the special things about this is because it's a social oppression, even if you are an atheist, you're a Catholic atheist or a Protestant atheist in Northern Ireland. It's like if you live in Germany in the 1930s and your family is Jewish, whether you believe in God or not does not help you. It's not the problem. It's not a religion. Yeah, you're Jewish. Yeah, you don't believe in God, you're still Jewish. And this is the case in Ireland, but also in England. I mean, certainly I personally am an atheist, but I'm also a Catholic. because in England the Catholics are a minority who are not treated as well as everybody else, although I don't want to exaggerate. And so certainly I would never say, oh, I'm not a Catholic, because it would be like, you know, not having solidarity with my own people. Yeah, pretty complicated questions of identity and discrimination. Although things are much better for Catholics in England than for Catholics in Ireland. So for 50 years, 1922 to 1972, Northern Ireland had its own parliaments. But when the British army went into Northern Ireland in 1969, it seemed no longer possible for the Parliament to function in Northern Ireland. So it was closed down in 1972, and went on to what we call direct rule from Westminster. However, it was started up again very recently. Well, not very recently anymore, 12 years ago, 14 years ago, the modern Northern Ireland Assembly elected in 1998, at the same time as the new Scottish Parliament and the new Welsh Assembly. The Northern Ireland Assembly, the modern Northern Ireland Assembly after 1998, still had some serious problems. Well, there it is. It's the Parliament at Stormont. That's not a very good photograph, actually, because the gardens are prettier than the building. And if you move back, you have this incredible garden that goes on forever. Stormont, yeah, Stormont. When you see the word Stormont in a text, it means the Northern Ireland Parliament, just like you have in French politics. You have places which represent. Think of what's the place where the it says Luxembourg, it's the Senate and so on. Stormont is the place, it's the Parliament, the Northern Ireland Parliament. Now this Northern Ireland Parliament continued to have problems because some of the Protestant political parties said that they didn't trust the Catholic political parties, and they said that they were still linked with terrorism. So this was the problem. And so it was for a long time it was impossible for them to work together. And so four times the assembly was suspended. But since 2007, they have been working together, and in some rather surprising situations, some of the leaders who were absolute enemies in the 70s are now working together quite well, quite amicably. It's a very controversial question. Of course, many people are happy that the Protestant parties and the Catholic parties are working together, but other people are saying, oh, well, they are only working together because they've both decided to do nothing about discrimination against Catholics. Same then in the rest of the parliaments. At the very end of the 20th century, 1997 in particular, heralded the triumphant return of the nations. It wasn't me who wrote it. It was Monsieur Lasalle, Chrisa. With the Scotland Act 1998, which created a Scottish Parliament with powers to make primary legislation in certain devolved areas of policy, in addition to some limited tax-varying powers. So what happened? Well, from 1979 to 1997, the Conservative government was in power, Margaret Thatcher in particular. And the Scottish were particularly unhappy with this because towards the end, I think there were no Conservative members of Parliament in Scotland. For a long period, there was one, and then there were zero. And so the Scottish, who feel themselves as a nation, said, No town in Scotland voted for a Conservative Member of Parliament, but all the decisions about Scotland are being made by the Conservative government in London. Because at this time there was no Scottish Parliament. This is in the 1990s. And so the demand for an autonomous Parliament became very strong. And Tony Blair, the leader of the Labour Party, promised during the 1990s, if we are elected, or when we are elected, we will organise a referendum in Scotland and in Wales to set up an autonomous parliament. Now, remember, be careful with vocabulary here. Autonomy is not the same as independence. Yeah. Independence, you're a separate country. Autonomy, you have a separate parliament which can decide on some questions, but not on other questions. So this was successful. In Scotland, the referendum voted very convincingly in favour of a Scottish parliament. So a Scottish parliament was established with quite a lot of power on education. And there are certain questions they have no power on. Defence. Abortion rights. Le droit à l'avortement. Une question qui n'a pas le droit de décider. Il y en a cinq ou six autres. Some very important. Let's say that the most important questions are still decided in London. But quite a lot. It's much more powerful than a conseil régional. Much more powerful. For example, education. In Scotland, if you want to go to university and you are Scottish, you pay zero. And in England, you pay €12,000. That's a big difference. And there are many more examples. In general, the Scottish Parliament has introduced more social legislation. And this is not finished. In 2014, there is to be a referendum in Scotland on Scottish independence. Now, no doubt the Scottish will not vote for independence. However, it's not decided exactly what the question will be on the referendum, but it looks likely that there will be three options. The same situation as today: independence or more autonomy. Not independence, but more autonomy, more power for the Parliament of Scotland. This is called the Devo-Max option. Maximum devolution. Devo-Max. Sounds like one of these drinks that young people drink, like Red Bull, you know, Devo-Max, you know. The Scottish National Party have a majority in the Scottish Parliament, yeah? The government in the Scottish Parliament, who cannot decide on some questions, because defence, etc., is not their problem. But the government is the Scottish National Party. They actually got the majority in the Scottish Parliament, which is very... They were very happy, yeah? And for the referendum, they are proposing to reduce the voting age from 18 to 16. And this is causing some conflict with members of Parliament in Britain, because some British members of Parliament have claimed that the Scottish Parliament does not have the legal right to call such a referendum. It's true that according to the Scotland Act, the Scottish Parliament does not have the right to declare independence. On the other hand, I'm not sure what England would do. Would they send the army? They could, but it's delicate, you know. I'm not expecting a civil war. But I'm not expecting the Scottish to vote for independence. But they may get more autonomy. And how much autonomy can you have? Difficult question. There are this parallels things which are happening in many other countries, but not in France. Spain, for example, at the moment in Catalonia, there is a demand for a referendum on independence. And the Catalans are much more in favour of independence than the Scots. So that's the situation in Scotland. The Scottish Parliament building, here it is. It's not a very pretty Parliament building, actually. It wasn't a great success. It's this thing here. Yeah, okay, that was a good idea, wasn't it? Yeah, okay. The Scottish Parliament building, which in Edinburgh. I think you should be... You should be counting your pennies and seeing how you can get to Britain to practice a bit of English and see some museums and get some more things into your head. I do recommend Edinburgh. It's not expensive on EasyJet, and really absolutely fabulous place. And of course, remember that in Britain and in Scotland, in England and Scotland, the museums are free, which is, you know, which is quite an argument. Yeah, I'm a great lover of Edinburgh. So here is the Scottish. Some documents of the Scottish National Party. What's the situation today of the Scottish Parliament? Remember, which has power over a lot of questions, but not defence and taxation. or general taxation. This is the situation. The Scottish National Party have 69 seats, Labour 37, and the Conservatives 15. The Conservative Party in Scotland is like... I mean, I wouldn't like to be a member of the Conservative Party in Scotland. You don't have any friends, you know. It's pretty bad. And look at the here you have a sticker from the Scottish National Party. Scottish National Party, it's time. Now, it's time for what? They don't say exactly it's time for independence, because, you know, there is a minority in favour of independence, but not that big. There's probably 25 or 30% in favour of independence maximum. But it's time for Scotland to be more important, for Scotland to be more respected, etc. And of course, it's a wonderful slogan, it's time, because sometimes you don't want your slogan to be too precise. So that's the situation. And here you have a book which is The History of the Scottish National Party. Certainly it's a triumphant situation for the Scottish National Party for a very long time. In the 40s and 50s and 60s, the Scottish National Party was a small, marginal party. And all their friends laughed at them, saying, why do you keep on being in the Scottish National Party? It's so small, and they'll never do anything interesting or important. And now they run the Scottish Parliament. This is a glorious vindication Scottish nationalists. Scotland exhibits a strong national identity. That's certainly true. People in Scotland feel Scottish. The accent is very easy to distinguish, easy to recognise. It's not generally difficult to understand except for Glasgow. Although this is a difficult question, because whether people understand accents or not is a political question. You can imagine in France as well, you know, somebody who says, oh, oui, non, mais tous les immigrés, je comprends même pas ce qu'ils disent. Ça, ce n'est pas une réflexion sur sa capacité de comprendre de la langue, c'est une réflexion sur la personne, surtout, sur son attitude. And you hear this in England, say, oh, I don't understand the Scots when they speak. This doesn't mean it's true. It means that they have hostility to people speaking in this particular way. But certainly, political organisation, well, you saw that, you know, the Conservatives are so small, and the Scottish National Party. Language is special in Scotland. A very small number of people speak Scottish Gaelic. It's not like Welsh at all. You will not walk around Scotland and hear people speaking Scottish Gaelic, except in the islands, and not every day. A very small minority speak the language. But a lot of people will speak Scots, which is a dialect of the same language as English. People often say Scots is a dialect of English, but you could say English was a dialect of Scots. Certainly, English is a more widespread and dominant dialect. And so people do, and we will see a little bit of that in a moment. And also national celebrations. For example, New Year in Scotland is much more important than in Britain. Much more important than Christmas. In Britain, Christmas is the big thing, and New Year is also celebrated. But in Scotland, Hogmanay, Hogmanay, is the big celebration. And there's also, at the end of January, Burns Day, which is the celebration of their national poets, the most famous poet in Scotland, which is kind of nice. There are not many countries who have a national holiday for a poet. And there are also cultural events such as the Highland Games, where there are particular sports which are not practiced elsewhere. Tossing the cabre, yeah, le lancer du tronc d'arbre. Yeah? Well, which is something else, isn't it? Yeah. I will bring a cabre next week, and I will expect you to. Something. Would you do that? Yes. I think Chloe would be very good at it. I'm sure. Try this. You see her face. Okay. Here you have a couple of road signs in Gaelic, or in bilingual. Fáilte gúd, yeah, etc. And now, what's important about this is that, in reality, 99% of Scottish people speak English. and can read English. But all the signs are in bilingual. So here, the language is not a practical necessity, but a symbolic necessity. And Scottish people want all the signs to be in bilingual, but they don't want to learn Gaelic. Yeah. So it's a symbolic importance. And now, symbolism is very important in people's identities. Yeah, very, very important. So you have road signs in bilingual across Scotland, despite the fact that it doesn't. I don't really think there are people driving around Scotland who only read Gaelic. It could help if you have some Bretons who don't speak English, then they could probably read the Gaelic because it's kind of close to Breton. But the most important thing about it, in my opinion, is that it is the importance of symbolism in identity. And symbols are always hugely important in identities. You know, if you want to be people, if you want to dress as a Gothic or punk or hippie, it's all about symbolism. Yeah. You're the wonderful punk. Safety pins, you know, les épingles de nourrice. Yeah. On revient à l'enfance. On refuse d'être adulte. It's all symbolism. Okay, now, I wanted to mention this gentleman, Robert Burns, who was an 18th century poet and is the national poet. And this is one of the most famous of his poems and songs. A man's a man for all that, malgré tout un homme c'est un homme. And it's about how the most important... First of all, that poor people are good, just as good as the rich, which in the 18th century, this is radical stuff. And so here you have it, yes. The coward slave we pass him by, on s'intéresse pas à l'esclave qui est lâche. On veut des gens, que les gens soient fiers d'eux, même s'ils sont pauvres. And finally, the rank is but the ghillie's stamp, the man's the goad for all that. Le rang social, c'est seulement la marque qui garantit une pièce. L'essentiel, c'est l'or. Le rang social, c'est pas l'essentiel. C'est ce qu'il y a derrière. And so, all through, he says, you know, it doesn't matter if people have silks, luxurious clothing. If people have wine, that doesn't matter. The only important thing is that the honest man, even if he is poor, he is the real king. The real king is the honest poor man. So that's the thing. And I'm going to let you listen to it, I think. Okay, so if you see this man called a lord who struts and stares, even though hundreds worship at his words, he's just a fool. So the lord is a fool. In spite of all that, his ribbons and his stars and all that, the honest poor man, the man of independent mind. He looks and laughs. He's not interested in all that. Yeah. And then at the end, it's a kind of sort of socialist call to the future. Okay, I'll put you the rest of it up on the the blog for you to listen to. Could you hear that? Yeah. Okay, that's good. You have better ears than me too. Ears and eyes, wonderful. It must be wonderful to be young. I can't remember. Okay. Well, let's just have a little look at Wales then. The flag of Wales then. Remember the importance of flags. A dragon is not a modest animal, okay? It doesn't have the same... If you choose a squirrel for your flag, yeah, that's a bit more modest. Yeah, so the famous place that I was mentioning to you last week, okay, which is the longest town name in the world. So, what is the... Yeah?
Why is the Welsh flag not the British flag?
Well, because they didn't really have... You know, it's like England, well, that includes Wales, you know, they're not important. They're, at the time of the... At the time of the development of the Union flag, there was no independent Welsh voice. So yeah, it wasn't. There was no negotiation. Yeah, it was, the problem was finished. Wales had been unified with England many centuries before. It was not a problem. It was not a problem for the elite. Yeah. So good question there. And at the same time, of course, if Scotland had an independent parliament, or rather, if Scotland had 1997. A referendum for an autonomous parliament. There was also a referendum for an autonomous assembly in Wales. Does anybody remember the results? Anybody remember that? Does anybody know what the result was? Oh, good. Okay, that's okay. I just want to check. I'm not wasting your time by telling you things you already knew. I'm not. No. Good. Thank you. Please stay so ignorant. Okay, 1997, they had a bit of a problem because they had a referendum for an autonomous Welsh assembly, like a parliament, and half the population stayed at home, first of all, 50% turnout. And of the 50% who voted, I think it was 50.2% yes, 49.8% no. So this is a problem, actually. This is a... Now, they didn't really have any choice because they had to organise a referendum. There was a referendum in Scotland, so you need a referendum in Wales. But there are times when you wish you hadn't organised a referendum, you know, because you find out that, well, most people don't care. Not good. And so you had this rather difficult situation where, like I say, half the people stayed at home, half the electorate stayed at home, and the other half voted with a tiny majority in favour of establishing a Welsh Assembly. And so they established the Welsh Assembly because it had been decided. But it's a little problematic because, first of all, it cost a lot of money. And, of course, they were very widely criticised because, you know, there was no wild enthusiasm. But nevertheless, the National Assembly of Wales was created by the Government of Wales Act in 1998 after the referendum in 1997. So part of the promises of Tony Blair and the Labour Party... and parallel with Tony Blair and the Labour Party in this period, 1997 to 2010, introduced a series of constitutional changes. And autonomous parliaments for Scotland and Wales was one thing. There was the reform of the House of Lords, which we'll probably come back to. There's the Freedom of Information Act. There were a series of constitutional reforms all at the same time. It's part of their programme. And so, because the Welsh Assembly was not so massively popular, it had less power. It was given less power. In particular, it could not raise taxes. Pour vous parler de levier des impôts. It could only decide how the government budget for Wales was spent and organised. Yeah. So a small amount of power. However, this is where comes one of the wonderful things about politics. Once the National Assembly of Wales was established, it became more popular. Yeah. So people who didn't care very much in 1996, 5 or 6 years later, when they'd seen the National Assembly, it got more popular. And so in 2011, yes. There was another referendum in March 2011, just last year, and I don't know the exact question, but was it? It was something along the lines of, do you want more power for the Welsh Parliament? And it said yes. And so now the Welsh Parliament... Pendant longtemps, on disait Welsh Assembly et non pas Welsh Parliament, mais je crois qu'on commence à dire... Welsh Parliament. Officiellement, c'est the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament. It's not quite the same. And so, now, the Welsh Assembly has almost as much power as the Scottish Parliament. However, there is no possibility... Just one moment. There is no possibility of a referendum for independence in Wales... Because you saw it was so difficult to get them to vote to even have a parliament, so independence is not on the cards, yes.
Why in 1988 a referendum was organised if the Welsh didn't want...
Yeah,
1998.
Yeah, okay. Right, yes, good question. 1997, in fact, because the law was in that. So 1997. Well, you see, the thing is that the 85% of the population of the United Kingdom lives in England. And so the promise of Tony Blair and the Labour Party was, we respect the opinion of Scottish people and Welsh people. So we don't promise a parliament, we promise a referendum about the parliament for Scotland and for Wales. It was kind of a pecky cadeau. It was because we have one in Scotland, we'll also have one in Wales. And in some ways they got the worst possible results. Because, you know, if they'd said no in Wales, well, it would have been more simple. But they said yes by a tiny majority, and so the government was obliged to establish a parliament that people didn't really want that much. You know, so it was rather awkward. But it was part of Blair's programme and presentation, We Are More Democratic. Margaret Thatcher didn't care about the opinion in Scotland, which is fundamentally true. But we care so much, we will allow you to choose if you want an autonomous parliament or not. And I have here a list of some of the areas which are devolved. So you talk about devolved areas and reserved areas. A devolved area is like health, le système de santé, is a subject on which the Scottish or the Welsh Parliament can decide. And a reserved area is a subject like defence, where only London can decide. Well, at least they had a better building. Yeah, there's the National Assembly for Wales in Cardiff. Oh yeah, sorry. So the Government of Wales Act 2006 created an. Sorry, that's not very important. What is more important? England is the only country of the United Kingdom which does not have a devolved parliament. And occasionally, every now and then, people say, hey, the Scottish have got one, and the Northern Irish have got one, and the West, maybe England should have one as well. But there is not a lot of support for this, because 85% of the population of the United Kingdom lives in England, and so the English are satisfied with having one parliament in London. So here's the Welsh Assembly today. The very important difference. Labour, 30 seats. Conservative, 14 seats. Plaid Cymru. Plaid Cymru is the Welsh Nationalist Party. 11 seats. And the Liberal Democrats, 5 seats. So you can see that the Nationalists are a long way. In Scotland, the Nationalists have the majority in the Parliament. In Wales, not at all. 11 out of, je sais pas quelle est le total, c'est 60, c'est ça? Oui, c'est 60. 11 out of 60 seats for the nationalists. So it's a politically, Welsh nationalism is much smaller, although linguistically, the Welsh language is much more powerful than the Scottish language. And underneath you have a joint poster. This is a poster advertising the Welsh nationalists and the Scottish nationalists. Yeah, so it's an idea, we have the same ideas, for Wales and for Scotland, protecting local services, protecting the vulnerable, fair funding for our nations and financement juste, boosting our green economies, helping our businesses grow. Now, of course, Plaid Cymru are happy to have a joint poster with the Scottish nationalists, who are much, much stronger. Yeah, so it's all around. And here are the list. Don't note the whole list, but just remember three or four of them, three or four examples. You can't possibly learn 20 of them. It's too many. But just to give you an idea, these are the 20 areas of responsibility devolved to the National Assembly for Wales. Yeah. So these are the things which the Welsh Parliament, the Welsh Assembly in Cardiff can decide without asking the opinion of London. Some of them are quite important. Housing, health, transport, education. They're not little things, yeah? So, as I say, much more power than a conseil régional. Vous savez bien que le conseil régional, qu'est-ce qu'ils ont à dire sur l'éducation? Rien. Rien du tout. It's not at all similar. It's much more like the situation in Spain with Catalonia and Galicia and Andalusia and so on. And probably in some ways the identities are similar, because if you go to Andalusia and you have too much to drink with your friends from Andalusia, they won't sing the Spanish national anthem. They'll sing the Andalusian national anthem. It's the same sort of situation in... I don't want to give too many examples connected with alcohol. I give the impression of being a dreadful alcoholic, and that's a secret. Okay, Welsh identical. Welsh identity is visible through the language. Traditional events such as the Eisteddfod. The Eisteddfod is a cultural festival with Welsh music and Welsh singing, Welsh dancing. In particular, folk music and dance. And one of the specialities of Wales culturally, the male voice choir. Donc la chorale masculin avec canson chanteur. A long tradition there. Choirs are interesting. They've remained very powerful in Wales, just like in the United States. Gospel choirs are still something which is very present. And finally, a surprising arrival over the last 20 years, a very specific Welsh rock music. Most of the songs sung in English, but some of them sung in Welsh. And here you have the pictures. The most... does anybody know Catatonia? This is the most well-known Welsh rock group, and from the 1990s. If you like rock music, you'll probably like it. It's pretty powerful stuff. It's pretty good stuff. And there is a picture of... not a very good picture, of the Eisteddfod, which is much more what you would expect, a sort of Celtic festival thing. The Welsh have been a little less successful, I think, in exporting Celtic culture. Because, as you know, Irish Celtic culture is exported everywhere. In Paris at the moment, you can spend €50 and get a ticket to see the Celtic festival of this and the Celtic festival of that. And it's all Irish. It's the Irish and the Bretons. But the Welsh don't seem to have a lot of presence. Yeah, don't seem to have a lot of presence, the Welsh. But maybe they'll have more in the future. So, without its own devolved parliament, England continues to be governed and legislated for by the UK government and the UK parliament. And this is occasionally controversial. And there is a particular constitutional debate called the West Lothian question. Now, I must admit, I don't know why this is called the West Lothian question. But the West Lothian question is very simple. It is the idea that people in Scotland vote for members of Parliament in the Scottish Parliament, who decide for Scotland, and they also vote for members of Parliament in London. So it's like the Scottish have two votes. You have, Scottish people can influence the government of England by voting for members in London, but English people cannot influence the government for Scotland. And so this is considered like not fair, yeah? A constitutional loophole, a constitutional anomaly, and for some reason which I have forgotten, and I'm not even sure that I ever knew, this is called the West Lothian question. So that you get it explained below. On devolved matters, on health, education and so on, Scottish MPs in London continue to help make laws that apply to England alone. And here you have a couple of jokes about this. West Lothian is a part of Scotland. It's a region. And when they arrive here in West Lothian, it says, West Lothian, don't even ask. Yeah. So talk about the West Lothian question. And I don't understand this. This is what a bloody awful mess. Yes, and it's a constitution in. Oh, I see what's happening. Yeah, but here on the television they're watching United States of America, a constitution in peril, and these people are saying, "Oh, it's terrible, the constitutional mess in America." But in fact, they are drinking whiskey and spilling it everywhere, and the whiskey is called West Lothian Question. Okay, it's not very funny. No, not really, no. Okay. Yeah, so here is the problem. No English MPs can make laws on those same matters in Scotland. It's a clear breach of constitutional equality, because normally any constitution is supposed to put you in a similar situation. Okay, so we've been talking about the Parliament and the new Parliaments. And these are important questions, and people are interested in them. When you have an autonomous Parliament, it reinforces national identity. Because if you actually have your own parliament, you start to feel more Scottish than before, I think. I think this is particularly important in France, because there's still a very strong tendency in France to think that Scotland is a region. And even when you say to French people, oh, non, l'Écosse se considère comme un pays séparé, un pays différent. The French say, oui, oui, bon, c'est ça, oui, d'accord. Yeah. But if you go to Scotland, you really feel it. You know, you don't feel that. And if you accidentally say, I'm here in England for 3 months, not gonna, you could lose friends like that. And it's easy to say, you know, it's easy to say accidentally, you know, especially because in French we always say Angleterre. In fact, even I say Angleterre, le Premier ministre anglais, etc., which is a mistake, but in French everybody does it. But in English, really don't. Don't, especially not in Glasgow. Where is this? Yes, it is Westminster, but which bit? The House of Something. Yes, it's the House of Something, Fiddles, thank you. This is the House of Lords. This is the House of Lords, okay. You can tell because they're wearing red. Now, this is the House of Lords. So the other part of the Parliament, very, very important, is the House of Lords. This was also the subject of an important constitutional reform. Do you know which one? Under Tony Blair, at the very end of the century. Yeah, this is a change which I'm very surprised that there wasn't more noise about it, because one of the problems is the words. When you see House of Lords, which is still the name of that part, then naturally, if you don't know about it, naturally think, oh, it's a place full of aristocrats. No, but it's the logical thing to do. Today, this is absolutely false. Yeah? The aristocratic power in the House of Lords has disappeared. But we kept the same name. This is Britain. Yeah, we don't change names. Yeah, and this happened in three stages. 1999, this was one of the big reforms of Tony Blair. A more recent development has been the change brought to the composition of the House of Lords by the House of Lords Act 1999. This act restricts membership of the House of Lords by virtue of a hereditary peerage. So a hereditary peerage is, you know, the aristocracy. Why are you a lord? Because my father was a lord. That's the traditional aristocracy. Until 100 years ago, everybody in the House of Lords... Everybody in the House of Lords was in the House of Lords for one of two reasons. One, my father was a lord, so I'm a lord. Two, I am a bishop of the Church of England. Okay, so that was the entire House of Lords in 1600, in 1700, in 1800, in 1900 was like that. But it's not today. And the biggest change was in 1999, which said the aristocrats, that is the people who are lords because their father was lords, will be reduced from 758 to 92. That is to say that they had a majority and now they are a tiny minority. And these 92 are going to disappear soon. This was a transitional situation. Okay. So, in fact, in 1999, and it's surprising because people don't talk about it much, Tony Blair and his government abolished the aristocratic principle in the British Parliament, which is quite a big change. So, who sits in the House of Lords then? There's still people there. Who are they? Say again?
Elected.
No, they are not elected. They are not elected. The members of the House of Lords are not elected.
Chosen by the Queen,
but who really chooses?
The Prime Minister,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. They are nominated. They are life peers, so they cannot pass their title to their sons and daughters. Yeah, they're just for the rest of their life. They are nominated by the Queen, but in reality, she always follows the opinion of the Prime Minister. So, like the Supreme Court judges in the United States, nominated by the President. That's right. But in this case, nominated by the Prime Minister. So the House of Lords is now full of life peers nominated by different Prime Ministers. Now, this is, of course, much more democratic. The members of the House of Lords are not elected, but they are chosen by an elected government. So it's obviously much more democratic than the aristocratic principle where they are lords because their father was lords. Yeah. So really there's been... it's an indirect democratic. It's an indirectly democratic house now that it is nominated by elected people. How do you become a life peer, a member of the House of Lords? It's... C'est un petit peu comme si le Sénat, au lieu d'être élu, le Sénat était constitué de tous ceux qui ont eu la Légion d'honneur. So it's an award from the Prime Minister for services to the country. Many of them are civil servants, les hauts fonctionnaires. Some can be sports people, rock singers, not so many. Trade union leaders. It is very usual when a trade union leader in England retires, they are nominated to the House of Lords. The idea being, oh, well, they're experts in legal things, so they will be helpful. Yeah. So that's the idea. But the important thing is then the change. This is the third reform. 1999 is the third reform. The first big change was in 1911. The first big changes were in 1911 when the reduction of the power of the House of Lords. So in 1911, the House of Lords was still completely aristocratic, but its power was reduced by a law in 1912 after a big conflict with Lord George and so on. I'm sure some of you half remember this. The second big reform was in 1958. For the first time, life peers were introduced. So life peers, that is to say, nominated lords and not aristocratic lords. And for the first time, women were in the House of Lords. And today, further changes are under debate, and the House of Lords may become an elected assembly like the Senate in France. It may, or it may not, we're not sure. An advance in the democratic principle. However, notice that this, if you wanted to mock the British a little bit, they're not very rapid, are they? Yeah, let's have a reform. We'll have a reform in 1911. Oh, let's have a second. Oh, hang on. We'll have a second one in 50 years' time. Yeah. So another one. Oh, wait, we're doing 45 more years. It's a very, very slow reform. And the last one is perhaps the most interesting, the Tony Blair's one, because there was no big demand. There was no big campaign reform the House of Lords. People were kind of used to it, you know. I have to explain this carefully because, of course, we always feel more democratic in France. But if you go to America, in any big city, the chief of police is elected. You elect the chief of police. And if an American comes to France, they say, oh, you're not a democratic country. You don't even elect your chief of police. That's very undemocratic of you. And, you know, and the French government could decide, if they wanted, to have the chief of police elected. But there is no campaign. There is no big demonstrations in the streets. We must have elected chief of police. It's not a question. And in the same way, the House of Lords was not a big controversy. And then Tony Blair, in a series of modernising laws, included this massive reform of the House of Lords. I don't really quite know why. And here you have a couple of funny cartoons. This one is impossible to read, I think. Yeah, but this one on the right, yeah. They had to choose 92 aristocrats in 1999 who would stay in the House of Lords for the time being out of, and this is the suggestion that they should play Les Chaises Musicales, that they should play musical chairs to choose the rest of them. Okay, next week we will begin with some of the history of freedom of the press and theatre censorship. One, do have a look at the blog. Two, you should already have started reading your first history book. Okay, see you next week.